Hey everyone, it's Jacob here. Welcome back to another episode of the Law of Code podcast. This is the show covering the legal side of crypto, NFTs, DAOs, and any other blockchain-related innovation.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Law of Code podcast. My guest today is Freeman Lewin, an attorney at DLX Law, where he advises clients in all matters related to blockchain, smart contracts, and tokenization. Freeman was part of the team that took a few years to dive into all the cases following Howey, as well as what an investment contract really is. In this episode, we'll be diving into everything there is to know about an investment contract, why it is important, where it originated, and what we mean when we say that based on the case law. Freeman, thank you so much for joining me today. Really looking forward to talking investment contracts with you.
Thank you for having me, and congratulations on all the success you've had with this podcast. I listen to it regularly, and I know that my father listens to this every week or every time it's out. So, hey, Dad.
Well, that's high praise. Thank you, Freeman. I'm excited after speaking with you and the DLX team on the podcast about what you could put together in the ineluctable modality of securities laws, and I'll link that in the show notes below. But you spent a few years diving into all the case law surrounding an investment contract, the Howey test, and I thought we could start with why an investment contract is important. What is the significance of being deemed an investment contract?
Setting the stage, the definition of a security determines the reach of federal securities laws. There is a policy dimension to how broadly and or narrowly the term security is defined. The Securities Acts define the term security to include an enumerated list of instruments. These instruments are prima facie securities, unless the context otherwise requires. We have notes, stocks, bonds, but then we also have this amorphous term, investment contract, which is the beating heart within this securities and regulation dimension. The investment contract term is borrowed from state blue sky laws, but without further definition within the statute. It is a catch-all category intended to cover novel, uncommon, and irregular devices, whatever they appear to be. So what does that mean? That means from a policy standpoint, over the years, federal regulators have tried to fit a wide variety of schemes under the umbrella of investment contract in order to regulate those activities as securities activities. And it's both ways. It is, you know, one side of the aisle says, well, this is not an investment contract because we want to loosen regulation. And the other side, you know, tries to wrap more things into investment contracts. So this is a cryptocurrency-oriented podcast. But before cryptocurrency, there has been many types of schemes that have acted as the push and pull for regulators to try to wrap their regulatory hands around these activities.
It is easy to forget, and I think many forget, that there are other definitions of a security and leave the idea of an investment contract. And the reason it's not defined is to catch all schemes that they want to fall under securities regulators' jurisdiction, but may otherwise not fit into the other list of enumerated definitions of a security.
It's exactly that. And I think we've spent many years focusing on investment contracts, but the securities industry and the cryptocurrency industry specifically has had to grapple with charges, specifically in the Terra Luna case, the complaint related to a receipt for a security. And that's one of the first times that the SEC used the term a receipt for to apply to cryptocurrency. They started off the complaint saying that Luna itself, the Luna token, was a security as an investment contract. And then the wrapped Luna, was a receipt for a security. So it's still predicated on the investment contract notion, but as we'll discuss further, it's a new type of allocation.
It sounds more like a derivative. And there are so many different ways to categorize something as a security, an investment contract. And following Howie gave us a test to evaluate whether these financial dealings that differed in some way from traditional securities like stocks or bonds, but still had the essential characteristics of a security, would fall within the securities regulator's purview. And on its face, this makes sense, right? If you're raising money, but you're calling what you're giving individuals in exchange for capital something other than a share, bond, note, etc., that should fall under the jurisdiction. And that makes sense on its face, where you had these instruments that were used to formulate a transaction where capital was being raised. But digital assets are different, aren't they?
Yeah, they're super different. I think that crypto is different for a variety of reasons, but one of those reasons is that it is not an instrument. It is not a written instrument as defined. It is just code. So there's no bundle of rights that are accompanied by the crypto asset itself. So when you think about the enumerated list of financial instruments that are securities, you see that each one of those is an instrument. It's a written piece of paper that contains promises to pay, promises to deliver, various conditional promises. But a crypto asset has no promises. It's just 6 or 7 lines of code. And while it may be accompanied by a promise in the initial sale, it's not that promise does not extend to the secondary sales. So when we talk about crypto assets not being securities themselves or not fitting within the investment contract scenario, we're not talking about that initial sale of XYZ token. I hope XYZ token isn't a real token, but we're not talking about the initial sale. We're actually just talking about the secondary sale. It may be an important step to step back to think about how the investment contract term came to fruition. People don't realize that the investment contract, as underlined in the Securities Act, is undefined. But it was a term that was common in many states' blue sky laws, and it was in existence prior to the adoption of the federal securities laws and has been broadly construed by states' courts. Since when you talk about investment contracts, the tricky thing is that you're disregarding form for substance, and the emphasis is always placed on the economic reality. So a great answer is crypto is different for a variety of reasons, but one of those reasons is that it is not an instrument. It is not a written instrument as defined. It is just code. There's a 1920 case in Rubber Co. that defined investment contracts as a contract or scheme for the placing of capital or laying out of money in a way that is intended to secure income or profit from its employment.
So that case would have been based on a state's blue sky laws, and that was the court's way of interpreting what an investment contract meant under those circumstances. This is why I was so excited to speak with you, because it's so nuanced, right? And you mentioned secondary sales as well, which to me is really interesting, where if you have an ICO, for example, and the founding team is pitching investors and they're putting money in, it's easy for everyone to understand the similarities and where it would fall under the Howie test. But when it comes to those secondary sales, and I thought the paper that DLX put out did a really good job of explaining this, is there is a difference, because like if you were to raise money through an asset sale or a share sale, you issue those paper contracts. But if someone gives that piece of paper to somebody else without any rights being ported over, or it's a photocopy of that piece of paper, that paper itself isn't what's at issue, right? What's at issue is the contract. And I want to discuss a bit more that separation between the instrument and the contract itself.
It's a great distinction, and I'll explain why the differentiation between contract and object is important. In Howie, the sale of orange groves to hotel guests, the orange groves themselves were not the investment contract, right? I think the distinction between a contract and an object is the most important distinction you can make in this environment. A lot of people, when they think about investment contracts, they think about traditional securities like stocks or bonds or notes that the contract and the object are one and the same. But when you think about cryptocurrency, you have to separate the object, which is the crypto, from the contract, which is the relationship between the seller and the buyer. But the seller of the cryptocurrency can disappear, but the crypto asset can continue. So just like in Howey, where the Florida real estate company sold orange groves to their hotel guests, the service contract, the real estate agreement, was the investment contract. But the orange groves themselves were not the investment contract.
It's a beautiful analogy, and I think it's one that seems to be lost on many people, especially when you think about the most obvious distinction that you raised there, is that the instrument and the underlying reason for purchasing and the company or any group of individuals that could prop up the value of this instrument. Those are two separate things. And when you were going through the cases, were there ever any instances where the instrument itself was what was at issue?
I will say, I think there's a confusion between the definition of instrument. Instrument is a written document. So the instrument itself is a contract. But your confusion there is what a lot of people confuse. So in every case, there was a written or implied contract. I will say that there's been a recent frustration of mine, and I think some in the industry, of this focus on investment contract, there needs to be a contract. That's not really the case. In Joiner, which happened a couple years before Howey, there was no written contract. It was an implied contract through pamphlets. The focus on contract is misleading because the courts can look to Joiner and say, well, there could be an implied contract. And where that is difficult is when you have projects in the cryptocurrency space saying that they have roadmaps or tweeting the great progress that they've made. Those are all well and good, but they do create implied contracts. We need to change the narrative to say that there needs to be a business relationship. Yeah. Every single investment contract that I've looked at, which is over 400, has contained a business relationship between the buyer and the seller. So when you think of your relationship to the Ethereum Foundation, I presume you, and I personally hold some Ethereum, I don't have a business relationship with the Ethereum Foundation. Now, there could be an implied contract, but it would likely fail in a court of competent jurisdiction in saying that I had an investment contract with the Ethereum Foundation because there is no business relationship.
The only relationship that you would have is hoping that they would continue to service and develop and move the ecosystem forward. It is so unique in the sense that why does someone buy Ethereum, right? I think the answer will be different depending on who you ask. Whereas why someone would buy stock in a company, the answer is relatively consistent, right? They want some form of return. They want to invest in the company.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets to, you might not necessarily be buying Ethereum because you expect the Ethereum Foundation or any core developer of the blockchain network to make any upgrades or change anything going forward. Just like when you create an email address, you're not relying on developers who created the underlying protocols to improve it in the future.
And not only that, you surely do not have a business relationship or a relationship with continuing promises between yourself as the buyer of Ethereum through Coinbase and Vitalik or the Ethereum Foundation.
Not many people have a business relationship with Vitalik, but those who do, I'm sure, would have interesting things to say. One thing I wanted to ask you, Freeman, is just on this point, during your case review, is there a case that comes to mind as being the biggest stretch of what could constitute a business relationship?
Not that it was found to be considered a business relationship, but when we started looking at the cases, we're looking at whether there was any cases where the court, there was an investment contract where they lacked a business relationship. Because we posited that the business relationship is the common enterprise element. And it may be a product of, you know, just the judicial system, but in all cases we found that there was no case where the court found an investment contract where there lacked a business relationship. But there is a line of cases, the Hawking line of cases, which dealt with potential investment contracts in secondary transactions. Hawking involved an individual investor looking for income-producing property and working with his real estate broker, which is the Dubois in this context. The Hawking family purchased a rentable condo in Hawaii from the condominium's original purchasers, the Liebermans. So what you see then is this relationship where the secondary market purchaser is purchasing an asset from a primary seller. And the question is whether there was promises made by the secondary market seller to, you know, the real estate agent that would induce an investment contract. That was not the case. The court found, you know, after being appealed en banc, that the sponsor, in this case Dubois, was not liable for selling an investment contract. So to answer your question, there's only been one really interesting case where the thread has been pulled to see how far implied contracts can go, and that's in the Hawking case, and the court found in the negative.
One thing I just wanted to quickly touch on is a prelude to Howie. How did we get to Howie being such a foundational case when it comes to investment contracts, given that there were previous state cases? Is Howie the first Supreme Court case on an investment contract following the Securities Act of 1933?
No. Oddly enough, the SEC brought another case a few years earlier in 1943, SEC v. CM Joyner Leasing for oil and gas. In that case, the court found that the sale and assignment of oil leases were not merely the sale of naked leasehold rights, but rather an investment contract, because the exploration enterprise was woven into the oil lease enterprise. Just as an aside, when you look at the cases, you see a development of topics, of industries. And in the early 1930s and 40s, most of the cases involved oil and gas and real estate. The big differentiating factor within these cases is the sale of real estate oftentimes was not found to be an investment contract when it was just the sale of a naked leasehold right to the land, or just a pure sale of real estate. But when the sale of real estate or oil was accompanied by post-sale promises or promises to develop the land, that was oftentimes found to be an investment contract.
It's such a good example of the difference between digital assets and tangible assets like oil and the intangible properties of an investment contract typically. Whereas now, through digital assets, it seems as though some regulators are attempting to tie in both the tangible and intangible nature of what people are purchasing into one entity, rather than seeing them more akin to oil or gold or a commodity that can be used. And I think in some cases, obviously, there is a reason for that, given that they can be sold to evidence some ownership of some scheme or some participation. What's interesting, though, is that happens often even without any contract or business relationship, like you said, to evidence that ownership. But the market tends to interpret it in a different way.
Right, but the market, that's really the mistake people are, I think, making, or regulators are making, is the market is not the seller of the security, right? The market is not the seller of the investment contract, and there's no relationship between the purchaser and the market. So whether the SEC is the appropriate regulator remains to be seen, but surely within the confines of the definition of the security, you can't just add crypto asset to that definition and have it work. It just wouldn't work.
Yeah, because regulators don't have the power to just arbitrarily add in new definitions, do they?
Well, no, they don't. But even if Congress did, I alluded earlier, mm-hmm. even if Congress had the power or did add crypto asset to that definition of security, as Rodrigo and the Paradigm team pointed out, the entire structure and framework of the Securities Acts would need to change, and the forms that we would have to give in. But even more so, a company can disappear and the crypto asset can continue. And that's what really differentiates.
And then what would happen?
Exactly. And who's going to disclose?
Yeah.
It makes for a little bit of a messy situation. But it is an obvious red flag when, if you just add cryptocurrency as an asset, if you think about adding cryptocurrency as an asset to the Securities Act, what would happen? And it wouldn't really work very well.
Right, because what happens to these post-sale obligations? When does the duty to the purchaser end? If the scheme is no longer occurring, there is no company behind it, the company's dissolved, the individuals have gone to different things. But then say, what if someone new decides to pick up the mantle who has no pre-existing relationship, never sold the tokens, etc.? It's such a difficult dynamic, and I think you made the statement, it could create a bit of a mess. I'm sure that's a bit of an understatement even too, of what would happen following something like a crypto asset being considered an investment contract generally.
Right. That's why in our paper we talk about establishing a new legislative regime. Whatever regime it is, we know that it's not going to fit neatly into the current securities as it stands now.
When you think of that case and the way the law has evolved over time, how do you apply the takeaway from that case to crypto in terms of the relationship between core devs, nodes, miners, all the different participants in the ecosystem? Where do you see that relationship fitting in, Freeman?
The basis of a facts and circumstance test means that in every single interaction and every single sale, you have to apply facts and circumstance tests. In crypto, whether miners or devs have fiduciary liability for unregistered securities transactions is sort of outside the scope of reality at this stage, I hope. But at the end of the day, if you were to look at the business relationship between any party, whether it's a dev, whether it's you, me, or a node, a miner, Ethereum Foundation, you would have to look at the business relationship between the parties. And that's what's so difficult about this is you can't come out to Congress and say every crypto asset is a security, because the crypto assets themselves are just objects. They don't have a representation. Normally, they don't have a representation of the business relationship.
When you think of the core traits of a business relationship and how those tie into an investment contract, typically there are those two things. It's the contract itself, something that evidences promises that transforms the asset into something more, right? The stock certificate is not just a piece of paper with writing on it. It is a promise.
Right.
Let's talk about the core traits of an investment contract. And the most obvious is a contract itself, something that captures any post-sale promises that would act to transform the asset into something more.
Right. So investment contract being an amorphous, undefined term within the Securities Act, and as I said, a very politicized term, finds its core definition in a case, UJ Howie, SEC v. WJ Howie. And in Howie, the court looked to whether the circumstances of a given contract, transaction, or scheme involved an investment of money, which is the first prong, in a common enterprise, which is the second prong, with the expectation of profits, which is the third prong, to come solely from the efforts of the promoter or third party, which is the fourth prong. And some district courts in the United States have combined the third and fourth elements. Those courts are frustrating because they often broaden the definition of an investment contract unnecessarily. So for some background on Howie, in Howie, a Florida company operating in a local hotel encouraged guests to tour orange groves. This is akin to anybody who's gone to Mexico, where I just was, and forced to sit on a timeshare experience. The orange groves were also owned by the Florida company, and guests were given a sales pitch and offered the opportunity to acquire a patch of land containing orange trees. There was two documented transactions. In the first transaction, the purchasing guests were given the opportunity to purchase the land. And in a second transaction, the guests were given the opportunity to have a Howie affiliated company manage the groves, harvest the oranges, and send the purchasers the net profits. Interestingly, in this case, and part of the Williams factors and part of the element of whether there's a reliance on the efforts of others, is the purchasers in Howie were mostly out-of-state purchasers that did not have, as a practical matter, the ability to cultivate the land in any way. The fourth part test to determine whether a particular contract, transaction, or scheme should be properly considered as an investment contract within the meaning of the Securities Act has been established and known to be the Howey test.
We've spoken about the prelude to Howey, the blue sky laws that I believe originated in Kansas and then spread throughout some certain states. Those were interpreted by courts. The idea of an investment contract was brought into the Securities Act of 1933, which led to the Howey case in 1946, which enumerated, I believe, for the first time, a test from the Supreme Court on what would constitute an investment contract. How has that test changed since then? And even when you were enunciating it earlier, you mentioned the idea of it was based solely on the efforts of a promoter or seller.
Yeah, so the test is obviously a living test, and it's expanded and been modified as competent courts have made decisions. There's two primary areas where I think the test has been changed the most substantially. The first was in a case in 1973 called SEC v. Glenn W. Turner Enterprise, and that modified the last prong of the test to the notion of it being solely on the efforts of others has been modified to require the expectation of profits derived from the essential managerial efforts of others. So you see that play out in what is the definition of essential managerial, whether the buyer has the ability or the knowledge to purchase and to run the company and retain a profit. The second one, which is the one that's most interesting to me, is this circuit court split between the definition of a common enterprise. Our review of the jurisprudence initially focused on common enterprise. Of the total 266 relevant federal appellate courts and appellate cases, 62 had more than a cursory reference to the notion, concept of common enterprise, and 37 of those which discussed common enterprise found that there was an investment contract as a result of a common enterprise. Now, every investment contract needs a common enterprise, but the vast majority have just made a cursory reference to it. And why is that? Well, there's two definitions of common enterprise. One is horizontal, and the other is vertical. And the horizontal commonality is found when there's a pooling of assets from multiple investors so that all the investors share in the profits and risk of the enterprise. Circuit courts in the 5th, 9th, and 11th Circuit have adopted another test, however, which is the vertical commonality test. So the horizontal commonality differs from vertical commonality, which focuses on whether the fortunes of investors are linked with those of promoters. And there's two types of vertical commonality, broad and narrow vertical commonality. The Ninth Circuit uses a narrow vertical commonality, which is focused on whether the fortunes of investors are linked with those of the promoters. And the Fifth and Eleventh Circuit focuses on the dependency of the investor on the promoter's expertise. What does that mean? So you asked, the original question was, have things changed? And the answer is, well, you have changes in essential managerial roles in Glenn W. Turner, but you also have changes in the definition of common enterprise. But even more so, you have a walking away from or a settling of whether common enterprise is actually important or not. And when I say that, I'm referring to the SEC's extrapolation of what the Supreme Court said in SC v. Edwards. The Supreme Court did not address commonality in Edwards, but the SEC has since adopted the notion that because the Supreme Court did not address commonality or common enterprise in Edwards, as saying that the common enterprise prong does not necessarily need to be elucidated upon or discussed as much as one would think. So when you see the SEC in complaints talking about common enterprise, you often see just cursory mentions of common enterprise because, as you saw in the SEC's staff framework in 2019, they effectively believe that common enterprise is no longer an element.
What's the main reasoning for that? Like, what's the justification to moving away from common enterprise? Is it because typically what they've found is that a common enterprise is consistent with these other prongs.
Right. Typically, they've found ways to associate market fluctuations and general pooling as consistent with common enterprise without having to go deeper into whether there was actually a business relationship. I have a nit with vertical commonality as a concept because it is predicated on externalities like the market moving.
Because if you're all buying gold and the price of gold goes up, you're not, that does not mean you're within a common enterprise in any sense of the
term. Right. And more recently, we used the concept of gold or diamonds or handbags. Just because the price of handbags goes up does not mean that you have a common enterprise with Hermes. I wish you did.
Right. Right. And I think the example of art is just to not give too many analogies, but if you take the idea of art, I think people could stretch and say, well, it's a common enterprise because if it, the artist themselves does something that puts them in bad taste among society, that could really devalue the art itself. Mm-hmm. But to stretch that and say every issuance of art or creation of art is a security just shows how broad the investment scheme could be pulled if you take it beyond its original intent.
The risk that we wholesale adopt crypto assets as being investment contracts themselves is not just a crypto asset risk. It really isn't. It's a risk that art or diamonds or handbags or chihuahuas or cars can themselves be considered an investment contract.
So we've spoke about the origins of why it's so significant, how it has changed since then. You also have alluded to many misconceptions, but I thought you could just rehash them here. And then to the most obvious is the idea that the Howey test is the sole test for a security. It is just a test for an investment contract, one of many of the enunciated definitions of a security. But did you want to touch on some of the other misconceptions you've seen? And you've mentioned them before, but if you could repeat them, I think that would be great.
You're exactly right. There's more than one test for what a security is. One great one is the Reeves test for whether a note is a security. But you also have, within the context of investment contracts, you have this understandable mistake that people think that an investment contract, it has to have a contract to create an investment contract. I think it's a really dangerous path to go down. The test is not whether there exists a contract. The test is whether there exists a business relationship. That's not even the test. It's the binding force is whether there's a business relationship. And if there's no business relationship between the seller and the purchaser, in our review of the cases, there would not be an investment contract.
When you see the discourse around Howey, around the definitions of crypto, even in light of the SEC actions against crypto asset platforms, as well as traders who are accused of insider trading. If you had to point to one fundamental misunderstanding, like where do you think the case law differs most from the interpretations that we've seen?
It's a great question. I think there's several fundamental risks and misunderstandings within the context of the SEC having brought actions against cryptocurrency companies as of late. One is the current in recent that elucidates that the existence of a fungible token creates a common enterprise between holders and the sellers. That the first allusion to that was but it has since been repeated. The Bittrex complaint and several other instances. The second one, and largely more established misunderstanding, is that the crypto assets themselves embody the promises made in the original sale. That one has played very, very recently, I believe, in the complaint. It was very obvious, but it also first surfaced in briefing in the
And so when you think about how things will play out going forward, it isn't a guarantee that new law won't be created that extends Howie. We've seen it extended to cases where there were efforts. In the Glenn Turner case, we saw, for example, the extension of Howie beyond just the sole efforts of others into somewhere. And the purchasers did participate in some form, but not fully. Where do you see that playing out, given how distinct digital assets are, and now that we are seeing them be discussed amongst the judicial branch of government in these cases? Where do you see the future of securities regulation?
It's really difficult to read the with the judiciary, but I think that since the paper has come out, the judge in the library matter, from what I understand, has read it. May go back and make clear that his opinion in the library case was not about secondary transactions of the library token. So I'm hopeful, and I'm always hopeful that truth will prevail. On the other hand, I do recognize that the SEC wins in about 82% of their cases on investment contracts. There is a huge, but I think that if it were to come down to it, at the Supreme Court level, there would become a clear distinction and clarity would be provided with respect to the fact that it is the business relationship that is the investment contract, not the object.
Well, that's comforting. And it's interesting to hear that they win in 81% of their cases. Is that cases generally?
I think it's close to 81. I'm not exact. I don't have the numbers. No, it is, let's say 80-ish percent of cases dealing with investment contracts at the federal appellate level.
To be honest, I'm almost surprised it's not higher when you think of what would have evidenced an investment contract prior to digital assets, right? There would have had to been something that people were giving money to. And it probably should be higher. And especially when you think about the cases that are brought in those situations, just from my experience on the securities regulatory side, cases aren't brought unless there is typically some form of fraud, some form of illegal offering, something that has gone beyond the purview of what's typically accepted. And digital assets really have only begun to see existence in case law over the past 10, 11 years.
Yeah.
And so, I'm not too concerned with that percentage of winning for the SEC. And I think crypto could be one where their numbers don't quite keep up.
You're right to point that out, that it's high. In fact, I do have the numbers now in front of me that courts have found an investment of the absence of an investment contract in 42% of their decisions, with a further 12% of cases being remanded back to lower court for additional fact-finding. That means that only 36% of the cases reviewed found the presence of investment contract.
There is hope.
There is hope, but the SEC has lawyers and great attorneys, so I do try. You know, when Gary Gensler came up, you know, recently on the House to speak, he said that he's brought something of 160 cases, crypto asset cases. But as you said, the vast majority relate to and things that are patent should be the security.
And it's interesting as well. I've been doing some research into stablecoins because the staff of the Canadian Securities Administrators, in a staff notice, which has the force of just guidance, it doesn't have the force of law, but could be relied upon in enforcement actions just as proof of non-compliance. They've said that stablecoins are securities and based that on the evidence of indebtedness prong, which I believe you have as well in the US under the 33 Act. But if you look through the case law, there isn't one interpretation where someone was given a commodity in exchange, which could maybe look more like a derivative, but there wasn't an example where somebody had purchased something for the purpose of using it rather than for the purpose of investing without any promise of return. And every scheme that I found on my review of the case law, it wasn't quite as exhaustive as what you have done with investment contract, but there was no evidence of anyone putting money into something where they were only guaranteed back what they had put in.
Yeah, oddly enough, I think the evidence of indebtedness is the new frontier. The Canadian Securities Administration, Ontario securities regulators have been much more aggressive on evidence of indebtedness than the United States. I think that if a regulator wanted to go deeper into evidence of indebtedness, they would surely have a lot to play with.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what the next few years look like. And that was fantastic. I think that went really well. Freeman, thank you so much for joining me.